You're listening to the Write Project podcast and radio program, a show about writing and modern Newfoundland author culture. This program is produced and recorded at CHMR FM 93.5 FM in St. John's, Newfoundland and Labrador, and is aired on other great stations in the province and elsewhere in the country. It can also be heard online at www.chmr.ca. I'm your host, Matthew LeDrew. Okay, folks, this is a cool episode. Today we're going to be answering the question, what is your favorite unknown book? So as a premise, I think anyone who reads has a favorite unknown book, a book that's just theirs. Everyone has one book that they love that nobody else has heard about or read for one reason or another. And it gives you this kind of sense of identity as a reader. It's like, everyone else can have J.R.R. Tolkien or George R.R. Martin, but this book, whatever it is, this book is mine. And when you're at a party and you whip out this book, no one else knows what it is, and for a brief moment in time, you can be the person in the know. You can explain what this is, what the meaning of it is, what's going on. It is very much a thing that happens, and it's never the same conversation twice because it's never the same book twice. So today, I thought it'd be fun to ask some of the greatest authors from our province what their favorite unknown book is. To that end, we have several authors on the line calling in, some of them bestsellers in their own right, some of them award-winning authors. We have Helen Escott, author of Operation Wormwood from Flanker Press. She's going to be on the line. We have Chelsea B., author of London Calling. We have John Dobbin, author of The Starving. We have Amanda Labonte, author of Call of the Sea and Supernatural Causes, which went bestseller last year. We have Diana Brown, author of Saltwater Joys. We have Ellen Curtis, author of Infinity and Compendium and editor of the From the Rock series. We have Brad Dunn, whose debut novel, After Dark Vapors, comes out this October. Keep an eye out for that. We have Bridget Canning, who was just shortlisted for the NLBAs for her novel, The Greatest Hits of Wanda Janes. And we have Mary Walsh, who was also shortlisted for her novel, Crying for the Moon. All right, it's going to be a great show. I'm going to kick off the ball rolling by letting you know about my favorite unknown novel. It is a very unknown novel. It was brought to me by a service called BookBub, which if you've never heard of it, it's a service in which you'll be given free ebooks every day sent to the email address of your choice. Great way to find new authors. I absolutely recommend it. My favorite that it gave me was a book by Colleen Helm called Carrots, which is the first book in the Shelby Nichols adventure series. This is a really weird book. It's an independently produced book, the type of book you can only get through indie press because it defies all structure. It starts off, it's called Carrots because the heroine, Shelby Nichols, is going to the store to get carrots one day, and she slips and bumps her head on the curb and gets psychic powers from that. And based on getting those powers, she starts a detective agency. It's a really weird, interesting novel. There are lots of cross-genre elements. You get lots of mob bosses in there. You get lots of crime, elements of crime and thrillers. You get lots of different points of view on different genres. You get some action, you get some at-home stories, you get some marriage drama, all of that kind of stuff. It's very much a mishmash of genre in the way that only an indie novel can be, because it hasn't been filtered through the process of a publisher's eye. They haven't gone through it and said, well, this doesn't fit in this genre, that doesn't fit in that genre. It's very much the equivalent of an indie film, but it's also done in such a way that it's structured as a blockbuster. It's structured as an action movie, which is why I love books, because you can have, in film, you can have either an indie film or a big effects-driven movie, but rarely both, because an indie film doesn't have the budget for effects. Books don't have a budget. It costs the same amount to write about an explosion as it does to write about two people sitting on the table. So books and comics are the rare medium where you can have indie voices, but in the big effects-driven genre film. And I find that excellent. I love the mix and match of the two. So that's my favorite unknown book. Let's hear what yours are, and let's hear from our authors. On the line, we have Helen Escott, author of Operation Wormwood. What's your favorite unknown novel, Helen?
Nothing comes to mind right away. I tend to read all over the place. I'll just go in and I'll get whatever book that kind of I'm in the mood for at the time. And like I said, I like biographies. I really love reading about people. But I love Dan Brown.
Yeah.
And I love reading his books. I really look forward to his books coming out.
I love him. I hate his dialogue. I wish he had at some point in his life heard another human speak so that he could know what it sounds like.
Yeah. And I kind of have this dream as a writer. I would love to write a book with Dan Brown. I would love for him to have Robert Langdon meet my character, Sergeant Myra, and get them to solve a crime together. That's my writer pornography dream.
Yep, that's fair.
On the line we have Chelsea B., author of London Calling. What's your favorite unknown novel, Chelsea?
I have two that I really, really love. One is a horror novella. It's called Disquiet by Julia Lee. And it's the title Disquiet really sums up the atmosphere very well. And it's not horror in the fact that it's like a creature feature or anything. It's just the character's internal struggles of losing a child. And the doctor kind of says, sometimes mothers who have a stillborn baby find some closure in spending some time with that child in the hospital. She takes the child out of the hospital and keeps it in her freezer for an extended period of time. And it is horrifying and real and so good. And Julia Lee in general is very underrated. She's also a filmmaker. She did a film called Sleeping Beauty. Very adult, but very raw and very good. There's also an author that I think is underrated. Libra Bray. She's most known for the Great and Terrible Beauty series, which did receive some
acclaim. I've heard of it.
It's pretty well known, that series. Her book, Going Bovine, I recommend to everybody because it's hilarious. It's about a teenager. It's young adult. It's about a teenager who escapes from the hospital when he has mad cow disease and he like hallucinates and he goes on this journey with his friend who also escaped from the hospital, and they get a garden gnome that's Odin, like the Norse god, and then they just go on an adventure throughout America. It's hilarious, but you don't know if he's hallucinating everything. It's so good.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really funny.
Sounds it.
And it's called Going Bovine.
All right.
The laughing out, because that's embarrassing, but it's hilarious.
The laughing's got to stay in. That's amazing. Okay.
On the line, we have John Dobbin, author of The Starving. What's your favorite unknown novel, John?
I think the Robert E. Howard books on Conan, all of his short stories. I don't think many people are aware of that.
Anymore. Like, there was a time when it was all that was known.
But I don't think, like, people, when they say Conan, they think of the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie.
Well, not only that, but it was too pulpy to be in school, and now it's too old to be current, so that stuff kind of falls away, when really I think there could be a pulp class. We could do that.
Oh, for sure. It's poetry is what it is. He just paints pictures for you.
Yeah.
We have Amanda Labonte, author of Drawn to the Tides. What's your favorite unknown novel, Amanda?
I don't know if it's an unknown book. It's a book that I read a long time. I was thinking like 10 years ago, but like it's probably like more like 15. And it's called Frozen Music. And I'm going to totally mispronounce the author's name, but I think it's Marika Cobbold. And she's English and Swedish, so I think that's why I'm having trouble with her name. But the interesting thing with the book, it's told from the perspective of two characters, and only two characters, and it does this thing. So it's a female character and a male character, and the female character is first person and the male character is third person. So when we're in the female character's perspective, we are in first person voice and we're in her voice. And when we are in the male character's perspective, we are in third person.
Interesting. I don't think I've ever seen that done before.
And the odd thing about the book, or the interesting, or maybe like the thing that I love about it, is the female character is a journalist, or she grows up to be a journalist. Like, we start with these characters from when they're children, and they don't know each other. And there are, like, secondary, periphery characters in both their lives that cross over. So they've vaguely heard about each other. They know each other exists. But, like, we kind of follow each of them on their different separate journeys. And what's really interesting about it is the female character feels like she would tell her own story. Like, this is my story, like, that she would speak in first person. And the male character feels like he would be the sort of person that would let someone else follow him around and tell his story, but he's not going to take the time to tell you his story. like that just feels like who those characters are, that she would tell it from her perspective and that he would have somebody else telling his story.
So like perspective dictates person.
Their personality dictated the perspective. And I don't know if the author did that on purpose or thought it through that way, but that's the way I'm projecting that she approached it, or that's how the muse came to her. I don't know, but
that's really interesting. You could say a lot about society there, where like the default like third person is also the male point of view.
Yeah.
And the like before the female character's point of view,
right.
You need to get inside her head kind of thing. There's a lot of cool stuff to say there.
And I spent most of the book waiting for these two characters to meet. Like I think that was what I wanted. Like there was a story happening, there was stuff going on, but I wanted to know what these two people would be like when they had like an actual interaction with each other. That was what I wanted. I wanted to know what they...
So interesting too to get like...
Because it could be any of us. It could be any two people you followed that like the writer knows are going to eventually meet.
Well, no,
and it's their lives before they meet. And it's not even like it's...
But if you have the first person, the female character who's got her stories from her first person point of view, so it's going to be subjective.
Yeah.
But when you meet her in the third person story, she might be different. It might be objective. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, because
and vice versa.
And I know when they meet, like what her whole backstory is, because I know, you know, as the reader, I know what she's gone through from her perspective. And then we get to him and it's like the first time he meets her, it's like what he thinks.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't want to spoil it if anyone reads it. It's not like a traditional romance or anything like that. Like, you're definitely interested in what these characters would think of each other, I think. But it's not like, oh, you can't wait for them to get together. It's like, it's more like their career paths and what they're doing with their lives. It's like, what will these two people be like? Because I just think that they would be really interesting to each other. And it's less about, you know, will they hit it off, and more about what will they like about each other and what will like drive each other nuts. Like I couldn't wait for that aspect of it. And it was a little bit literary, but it was not like when I started reading it, like I had to finish it. Like I could not finish that book.
Cool.
I think the first time I read it, I remember being like exhausted by the time I finished it, because it was like the middle of the night. Like I had to know how those two characters like ended up.
I had that recently with a book, a graphic novel, Blankets. I started it. I borrowed it from my editor, and I started at 8 at night, and I was up till 4 in the morning. Like I just couldn't put it down.
It's not a genre book. It's not like anything like that. I just felt like, and the plot was interesting, and it's one of those books where when you figure out why the title is what it is, like it's like boom, it's awesome, and it's, you know, it's emotional and it's uplifting and it's everything that like I want a book to be, but I picked it up off of the sale rack at Kohl's and didn't really think much of it.
Yeah, just a nice cover.
Just a nice cover. It had a well-written blurb on the back.
Yeah.
And it seemed like maybe it would be like a fun, you know, interesting read. And then, like, it was awesome. And like I said, I handed it off to my sister and she thought it was an amazing book as well. And, you know, we really enjoyed it. But I've never heard anyone else talk about it, so.
Interesting. Okay, we have Diana Brown, author of Saltwater Joys. What's your favorite unknown novel, Diana?
A lot of mine are like classics, and like the one that I've always drawn to is Wuthering Heights.
Okay.
But that's like a real... Have you?
I have.
Yeah, so, but that was like a high school... Maybe that's
college
too...
College for me.
Yeah.
You liked Wuthering Heights?
I loved Wuthering Heights. I did.
I remember that being one of those ones I was like, okay, I'm going to try to read it as an ebook. You know,
yep.
College student on the cheap, kind of, let's buy it by ebook.
Yep.
Nope. Okay,
no?
Let's get the print book.
Yep.
Nope. Okay, let's get the audiobook. Nope. I ended up just...
Real? I have two of the books. One of them completely written up because I write
Make
on...
notes.
That's another quirk. Yeah, I write notes on everything. One of my favorite reads is actually Edgar Allan Poe. So there's the many poems and the many, so like, for example, one of the characters, Annabelle Lee, is borrowed from his poem, Annabelle Lee.
Yeah.
There's, but anything by him, I can just read for hours.
Really?
Really.
Interesting.
Yeah. So.
John Dobbin has a giant sleeve of Edgar Allan Poe.
Oh!
Like just all his tattoos. He's very tattooed up, but they're all literary tattoos.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. He was very upset. I was in a writing class with him, and a bunch of younger authors saw the very lifelike portrait of Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah.
And were like, who's that?
Wow.
Is that Bryan Cranston from Breaking Bad? And he was like, he just pointed to the door and was like, go away.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Beautiful.
On the line, we have Ellen Curtis, author of Infinity and the From the Rock series. What's your favorite unknown novel, Ellen?
This is going to be a weird one, but I recently picked up a bunch of children's books, and one of them was a Neil Gaiman one called Cinnamon. And I really...
Synonym?
Cinnamon.
Synonym.
No, cinnamon. And it's, you know, par for the course Neil Gaiman, it's dark for a children's book. And I really enjoy it. Because
he does like ruining childhoods.
I wouldn't say that. I would say it's an appropriate level that doesn't pander to young people.
Cool.
On the line, we have Brad Dunn, whose debut novel, After Dark Vapors, comes out this October. What's your favorite unknown novel, Brad?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with John that, like, it'd be great to see that return of the kind of American sword and sorcerer type stuff. I wonder, like, if there's, like, a novelist that needs to be rehabilitated almost.
King? No.
I mean, I think he's having a great renaissance moment. And that guy, I wish he'd spend some more time editing. Like, I read his most recent novel, The Outsider, and it's like, I'm just like, man, you need an editor. I don't know, like, I guess there's no one...
You do some editing work. It's gotta be hard to edit King at this point. Like, can you imagine if you got hired to do that right now? Like, how do you say to King, you know, maybe all your characters don't need to be authors?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much repetition in this novel. I can't imagine anyone didn't realize that. Why isn't anyone saying, hey, you don't need to repeat this for the fourth time? The reader understands the plot. And it's the same when I read George R. R. Martin. Is there no one telling you? I know you have this nice reference material you want to show off. You don't need to spend a whole page describing Tywin Lannister's armor. You know, like, totally interrupting the battle.
It is a major issue with both of them.
That's what I would love to know. Is it that these publishers are afraid of their authors? Is it that the authors don't want to hear it?
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, once someone sold hundreds of millions of copies doing one style, then it's like, well, clearly it works, so let's not mess with it.
Yeah. Even if... That's a good point, too.
Realistically,
like,
you can find flaws in it. Because at the end of the day, the editors are employed by the publisher, and the publisher just wants to... make the money.
Yeah, I almost wonder if that's more of it, is that we don't want to accidentally kill the golden goose.
Yeah.
It's like, Stephen King, just let him off the leash. Mm-hmm. Let him just write whatever nonsense he wants to write.
There's that famous Family Guy thing where he's like, it's a killer lamp.
There was a story, I remember someone asked him, maybe it was about that Family Guy episode, and they said, you know, it's one of those, like, where do you get your ideas?
Yep.
And there was a story where he's like, I was washing the dishes, and I thought, what would happen if a finger just started coming out of the sink? And I wrote a story about it. And it's like, the guy tries to cut the finger off. And, like, all of a sudden, it's like, that's how he writes, you know?
Yep.
And it's just, I feel like there's no block between what his brain says and what his hand does.
Yeah.
It's just pure output.
Yeah.
Like... it just goes out, you know?
Which is admirable in way.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, if I had that image of, like, the finger coming up, and I'm not saying I'm better than King by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
But that would be something that I would file away and I would put in a story. Like, in a larger story with themes and stuff like that, I'd do a thing where a character has an anxiety dream and that's the anxiety dream. And I would put all that same cool imagery and stuff like that in there.
But, you know, it's...
It's hard to criticize because he's him, you know what I mean?
If you don't like the kind of stuff that Stephen King writes and you want to be a writer, I would still suggest reading Stephen King, because it should embolden you to just chase whatever insane idea that pops into your head and see where it goes.
I wrote my thesis on The Dark Tower. I mean, there's, as much as I find flaws with a lot of his work, that's one thing that I'm like, no, this is everything.
Like, my favorite Stephen King book will always be It, because it was such a special, like, I read it at such a, like, special time in my life that it really, like, I think I was, like, 13 or 14 years old and feeling like, I've never read anything like this.
Yeah.
I didn't know you were allowed to write this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Like, the real book will never be turned into a movie or
TV show. Well, it can't be for a couple a few scenes really can't be.
There's one, I mean, the infamous, like...
We know the scene.
The infamous scene that I'm sure people know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But there's other stuff, like crazy parents getting possessed by Pennywise and throwing their baby in the toilet.
Yeah.
Like, that's, like, you could never put that on television.
No. Nope.
You could never put that on screen. Like American Horror Story pushes the envelope. They'll never have something like that on it.
No.
You know, and that other scene included, it's like, you could never write that unless you just turned off that inner editor in your brain. By the same, and it's like, you know, that obviously goes too far, but then I feel like at the same time, that brings with it all the great scenes with Pennywise and all the great stuff that King does. But, you know, it would be nice if you had an editor every now and then be like, well...
Maybe you don't need to do this.
Maybe we don't need that.
Steven, did you think of an ending before you started writing your ending?
Yeah.
Have you ever read Needful Things?
No.
Oh my lord, the ending of Needful Things. When you're writing, when you're watching a movie or reading a book, you can't help but your brain has a predictive nature to it.
Right.
So you see things happening and you guessed, okay, based on the dominoes that have started to fall, here's where I think's going to go.
Right, yeah.
And in a good novel or a very well-written novel, then there'll be a twist at the end, but the dominoes, it'll still have a cause and effect motion,
yeah,
where it's like, oh, the ending still makes sense. It's just not what you thought was going to happen.
Yeah.
King's endings, man, it's just like... Set the dominoes up, set them going. At the end, completely ignore the dominoes, get at your chest set.
Yeah. He's got a thing about endings. John Irving? Well, I think Irving writes his endings first.
Sounds like a good way to do it.
And Stephen King apparently thinks that's like absolute blasphemy. He's like, I save my endings till I get to them, which is probably why they're so crazy.
He doesn't save them, though.
Yeah.
He's like, well, I guess this book's done now.
Yeah. On to the next one.
Like Needful Things, spoilers, ends with a sheriff making shadow puppets to scare the devil out of town.
Right.
Like, he just, apropos of nothing, just makes a dog as a shadow puppet, and the devil runs away.
Yeah, I mean, and then there's the stand with, like, the hand of God and stuff. And, yeah, that was ill-advised.
There's so much that's ill-advised.
I don't know how obscure this book was, but I loved Redwall when I was a kid. I'm not sure how, like, obscure that might be, but
I think we can go there.
I think that was an excellent book. It's one of the books that I would really kind of highlight as, like one of the big key books that really just kind of pulled me into literature, that came at, that I read at the right time in my life.
What's it like? Because it's on my to-read list. It's been forever. It's been on my to-read list for 20 years.
Yeah.
And I look at it every time, because that's the one with the mice, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I look at it and I go, Secret of Nim, but for fantasy. That's what I think, because the art style on the cover, I go, oh, it's Secret of Nim, but for fantasy. I mean.
Yeah. I don't know when the timeline of those novels. How old is Secret of Nim? Well, anyways,
Brian Jacques is the author.
Redwall. Yeah, I feel like Secret of Nim probably came out before Redwall.
Yeah.
Redwall, it's like epic fantasy for kids.
Yeah.
It's awesome. I remember reading when I was like 12 and thinking this is like Ocarina of Time, but like as a book, which is cool. And yeah, just kind of that like Joseph Campbell monomyth kind of stuff, like the hero's journey.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of really got me into that kind of stuff. I remember picking it because I think it was like grade 7, and we had to choose. It was like the first year they let us choose what novels we wanted to read.
Yeah.
And I chose that one because there was mice, rats, and I think I liked the Secret of Nim movie.
Yeah.
And I read it, and it was like, oh, I can actually have fun reading. Like, I like rediscovered the joy of reading. We'll say that you kind of like, there's a, like, as a little kid you like reading, and then you, especially like when we grew up, there was like video games, and you know, you kind of get away from that and you don't think it's fun anymore, but then you kind of rediscover, you're like, oh, this can actually be really cool, really fun.
One hopes you rediscover it somehow. Yeah. Yep.
You know, yeah. Kids' books back then were so much more intense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of like the old school Pixar kind of thing.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, and Don Bluth movies before that, like the All Dogs Go to Heaven, Land Before Time, Secret of Nim, like not afraid to go a bit dark in your children's lit.
I think, too, like, I think around that time, I would have read Narnia for the first time. So obviously when the lion, Aslan, when he dies, and I mean, that's obviously very emotional too.
He comes back though.
True. Yeah.
That's an unrealistic lesson to teach a child.
But I didn't realize it was an analogy for Jesus at the time.
Yeah, there is that.
On the line, we have Bridget Canning, author of the greatest hits of Wanda Janes. What's your favorite unknown novel, Bridget?
Oh, my gosh. I feel like anything I say, people are going to know what it is. So I'm trying to think here. I remember years ago, I read this book called Geek Love by Catherine Dunn, which I think has a bit of, it's got quite a cult following. So it probably is quite known, but it's basically about this family that are traveling freak show. And the parents purposely take poison and drugs so that they have deformed children and put them in the freak show. And the narrator for the story is this albino dwarf, some of dwarfism, and you know, they're the most basic family, and they're telling them, and it was just, oh god, it was just, it's one of those books I'm meaning to reread, but it really stuck in my mind as just being just so completely different, and I hadn't heard about it. A friend gave it to me, and yeah, that's one that always, have you heard of that book before?
I have heard of it. I've never read it and didn't know what it was about. And now I think I imagine based on the title that it was a love story between two nerdy people, like two people who love Star Wars.
No, it's about like geek, like you bite the heads off chickens.
Now I have like, to read
that. And, you know, this kind of, dysfunctional family that's taken to the extreme kind of story. Libby Creelan's book, Split, is a local book that I read a few years ago that is just great. I really, really like it. She's a local author that I think should be getting a lot more exposure. I don't know. Like, I don't know her that well. I've worked with her a couple of times. I've spoken to her a few times. But she's someone who is underestimated as an amazing local author.
Okay. Sounds good. I'll check her out. On the line, we have Mary Walsh, creator of This Hour Has 22 Minutes and author of Crying for the Moon. What's your favorite unknown novel, Mary?
Oh, my favorite underappreciated novel. Well, I think all the novels of Faye Weldon, really. Like, because she's always sort of dismissed as a chick lit kind of person. And it's like, I just read her latest novel, which is about getting old. And I thought, wow, here I am reading Faye Weldon, and I'm learning things about growing old. And it was like, and when I was in the early 70s and was just a young woman, you know, maybe an old teenager and a young woman, I learned how to be that from Faye Weldon and Doris Lessing and, you know, all that crowd, right? But I don't think people don't speak of Faye Weldon anymore. Doris Lessing won the Nobel Prize, right? And so she's recognized, but Faye Weldon is kind of forgotten. People are remembering Colette again, which is good. And Jean Rees, oh my God, and nobody talks about her. She, The Wide Sargasso Sea, one of the best novels. It's Mr. Rochester's wife who's from, it's from her point of view, and she's from the island, you know, from one of the Caribbean islands, and is locked up in that attic. It's a great Jean Rees, and yeah. So all those people I read when I was coming to, you know, coming round, yep. growing up, yeah.
How do you feel about the term chick lit, just out of curiosity? You brought that up a second ago.
Well, there's no more guy lit for me. And no more guy flicks either. Like, I really, I know now that the guy with the superpower is things are going to be all right. It's going to work out. Iron Man is going to use his iron fits to make things fine. I know the story. Some guy gets done wrong. He starts shooting up towns and people. It'll all be all right in the end. I don't need to hear that story anymore. I don't need to see any more guy flicks. I definitely don't need to read any more guy lit, you know? That's so it's fair. All chick lit for me from now on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love reading the material. I hate the term because it seems to be so often the only difference.
Oh, it's so dismissive and contemptuous.
And it's just the same plot as like a male character, but with a female. And so they've created a new category. I'm like, why? Why can't it just be just be thriller, you know?
Yeah. I know. And certainly, but chick lit usually used to be like those shopping, you know, like Prada and When Life Gives You Lululemons and Judy Picoult, and that used to be dismissed as chick lit. And now, and you know, I still know men who I like very much who wouldn't be caught dead going to a movie that was about women.
That's weird.
Because men have no interest. Well, it's like the powerful, the people who are in power have no interest in the slaves, right? Whereas the slaves are fascinated by the people who are in power because, of course, their very lives depend on it. It's like predator and prey. You know what I mean? The prey knows what the predator is going to do. The predator is not as interested in the habits of what he's preying upon, right?
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on again. For all of you, we'll be here again next week at 4:30 Newfoundland time or online at chmr.ca. Please tune in and we'll talk more about writing culture in Newfoundland.